a lot of young men looking for help and guidance. And that is encouraging to me. Young men who are, how do you want to say it, based, I guess. they really are conservative.
How does one say?
Yeah.
right.
Chads.
Welcome to the Stand Firm Podcast. We are recording this episode on Tuesday, October 29th, 2024. I'm Nick Lannon of Grace Anglican Church in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm here with Matt Kennedy of the Anglican Church of the Good Shepherd in Binghamton, New York, and J.D. Koch of St. Luke's Anglican Church on Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. How are you guys doing today?
Very good.
Yeah, great, Nick. Thanks.
We have, I can't tell if it's new news or old news from Justin Welby at this point. He's making waves again. Why don't you recap for our listener what he's said and why it's new/old news?
Well, he was in an interview this last week, I believe it was, and he was asked again about his position regarding sexuality, and I think this is the first time he's actually said it. I mean, of course, we've had our suspicions, but he said that he's in favor of two people having a sexual relationship, whether they're heterosexual or homosexual, so long as the sexual relationship is within the bounds of a
quote unquote committed couple.
Yeah, committed couple. What does that mean?
See,
right?
Yeah. Love to see the definition of that too.
right. So then Lambeth Palace had to put out and then Lambeth Palace had to put out a press release basically confirming what he said, and it wasn't off the cuff, but also then kind of holding on. His position is just his personal position. It's not the position of the church, but it is the position of the church. If it's not officially, it's going to be soon. You know, I called this back in 2014, not to toot my own horn, but I called this back in 2014 when everybody was saying, oh, look, we've got an evangelical from Holy Trinity Brompton going to the Archbishop's chair. No, you have a theological liberal from Holy Trinity Brompton going to the bishop's chair, who's already talking about compromise with the left on homosexuality, as he was back then. He was saying this is not a thing to divide over. This is just a,
that's right.
So here we are.
Well, and he was no better on that than Rowan Williams was before him. I mean, it was the same sort of. And what's the case? I mean, when I was over in the Church of England for the first 6 years in the Diocese of Europe, and I mean it was an open secret, or if a secret at all, that this was a position that most people held, you know, that they were just waiting for the liturgy to be brought in line, because then somehow liturgical formations, legitimize everything. So they were just waiting. And, you know, the mantra that you kept hearing was to bring order into disorder, you know, bring something that is, but of course it wasn't the actual relationship itself that was disordered. It just that it hadn't been blessed or solemnized. And this is just the long walk. I mean, in a certain sense, they got what they sort of strategized about. You know, they're going to wait until the certain generation begin to retire or go to glory, and that the younger people, the younger bishops and the younger clergy were going to be indifferent, if not supportive of, quote unquote, gay marriage. And that's what seems to be happening.
And he says this just as he's nearing retirement. And so he's setting up the church to call somebody next who will just move this football further down.
Right. It's not going to be acceptable in the next election to have someone who's on the other side of this.
I can't imagine being in these positions of leadership, knowing the sort of historical timeline that we're in, and then looking back in history and forward to obviously the eschaton, and thinking that you are going to be known as the responsible party for leading the sheep astray. I mean, that's, you know, whether it's the archbishop or the regular bishops, I mean, it's bad enough being a rector, you know, or a church leader who's heretical. But I mean, we're talking about, as Al Mohler was saying today, you know, the titular head of the entire communion, you know, however fraught that is at the moment. And I don't know. I mean, there's an amazing amount of either cynicism or hubris or both, which would be an interesting combination, to sleep well at night knowing that you have that you are overseeing this. And I don't know. It makes me, you know, sometimes it makes me shudder, you know, to think about, to consider.
Well, if you're going to be so blatantly lying to everyone else, you might as well just include yourself in the group of people to whom you're lying. I fully expect that these men, well, be included, are just lying to themselves. I mean, I can't tell you how frustrating it is to hear somebody as theoretically august as the Archbishop of Canterbury say that after much theological study and prayer, it's like, what theological study are you doing? Can you share with me your sources? What new thing has come out? Has St. Paul written you a new letter? Just tell me that you're tired of defending a culturally unpopular position and you want out of it. Just say that.
I mean, two things here. One, it vindicates the action that GAFCON took last summer.
Amen.
And basically saying we have no, until the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Church of England repents, we have no connection to them in an authoritative sense, which was, I don't think the Archbishop had said something then. I think some church-wide decision had come out. I forget what it was, but there's something that prompted the GAFCON to make that move, and people were criticizing it. But now we see that they're totally, totally vindicated. But secondly, on the point that you were making, the Hayes's book, The Whitening of God's Mercy, Remember when they announced it was coming out, and they've changed their mind. And I was thinking for several months between the time of that announcement and the time the actual book came out, oh no, has there been some new exegetical insight that we just missed for 2000
years? There's another Qumran.
That's right.
is there some great, some great insight into the Bible that we've missed? And there's absolutely nothing like that. There's like no exegetical portion of that book has anything to do with the actual parts of the Bible that have to do with homosexuality. It's all about God changes his mind, therefore he's now for affirming LGBTQ. That's it. That is the summary of the argument. Look at these times in the Bible where God has changed his mind. Oh, and there's times in the Bible where it says God doesn't change his mind, ignore those, but focus on the ones where it says he does change his mind. And now look, he's now for LGBTQ to full affirmation because his mercy is widening. It was that badly argued. but I mean, it provides cover, right? Oh, look at these scholars. They have this this argument that we can now latch on to, but it's just so bankrupt.
Well, to be fair to the Church of England, bishops, at least, there has been some pushback because, as was noted, I think the Irreverent
Podcast
guy.
Some calls to resign, right?
Well, I haven't seen that, but I wouldn't be surprised. But there's certainly, he seems to have overstated the case of the quote unquote consensus of the House of Bishops. And then there was a response by the Church of England Evangelical Council, Andrew Stoddard, wrote to that end. He said that, whatever you think of the prayers of love and faith, there's still a lot of dissent. And at least the argument goes, again, I don't see a roll call or head count, but that it's not the overwhelming majority, maybe a slight majority of the bishops sort of agree with the two archbishops. But it seems to be trending that direction. I mean, the fact that there hasn't been, real support of a ACNA, GAFCON type reaction to this clear trajectory seems to indicate that there's at the very least going to be a communion partner bishop type, resolution at the end of this, where people ultimately will normalize by proximity these, sinful lifestyles. And that's what the increasingly insignificant number of people that are going to church, the diminishing number of people in the UK will, if they go to Church of England parish, they will be desensitized and indoctrinated into this new cultural way of life. And that's just sad all around. Sad all around.
So you guys both attended this Perseus conference over the weekend or the last week in Spartanburg, South Carolina. Give us the review. We saw some things online, but we want to hear it from the horse's mouth. How'd it go?
I thought it was an excellent conference. I had a great time.
Yeah, it was great.
I'll confess to having a little bit of trepidation going into it, just because of the titles of the talks online, Mighty Men of Valor. And I thought, come on, man. It seemed at first a little cheesy, but actually the talks were not cheesy. And the actual conference itself wasn't. And I think a lot of people were helped. But what was interesting to me is the number of young men who were there, who were seriously hungry for a father. It seems like, or a father. I'm not saying they don't have fathers, but
a father in the faith.
A father in the faith, right? Someone who can help them like think through their relationships, think through how they are in the church, think through their life. And it was, there was a real genuine hunger on the part of these guys. There were some older men there too, but there was a lot of young men looking for help and guidance. And that is encouraging to me. Young men who are, how do you want to say it? Based, I guess. they really are conservative.
How
men,
does
right?
one say?
Yeah.
right.
Giga Chads.
So no, it was encouraging. And then there were several things that were kind of funny, and that was, you know, JD walking in with his evangelical blue clergy shirt to this very high Anglo-Catholic worship stuff. I enjoyed that was fun. The worship was very, very Anglo-Catholic, or not, I wouldn't say anything, a very high church.
Yeah,
high church. And
I never experienced anything like that. Honestly, it was beautiful. I mean, it's just, as I said before, it's thorough. They covered they used all the rubrics, all the things. But it was very well done, reverent.
Yeah, it was.
You know, Matt preached a great sermon the night we had. I, like you, didn't know what I was getting into. I wanted to see you and I wanted to see Calvin. And it was a 4-hour drive. So I was just going to go and then one of the speakers pulled out. And I, as I said, I guess I was on the alternate list or something, but it was great. And I was touched by the sincerity and the reverence and the spirit of the thing. I thought it was really well done. And Father James, I don't know how to pronounce his last name. I did a good job. He's a relatively new rector there, and he's trying to build that church back up. It's one of the continuing parishes, but you know, what's funny is I felt my age really for the first time in a very dramatic way, because I kept wondering why these young men wanted to come talk to me and ask me questions or taking notes on what I was saying. And then I realized it's because I'm the old guy at the conference. Yeah, right. Speaker. And like, I was like, oh yeah, I remember being this guy at 22, you know, 23, going to conferences or like in seminary and being hanging on every word of some professors, you know. It was touching. I spoke on men in the home, which, as I admitted to, was somewhat of a confessional to me, because as we've said here on this podcast before, you know, for the first 10 years of our marriage, Liza and I were really wrestling and with some confusion about men and women in the home, you know, about questions like headship and leadership and responsibility and submission and all these very biblical concepts. We were being sort of remolded, in part because we were wrestling with our then infertility problems. And so all of the things I was able to confess a little bit from the beginning and say, you know, I'm sort of being reworked here some of these past 12 years or 11 years of our marriage roughly. And so, but it's been better late than never, you know? And so I was able to sort of give a vision that is still in formation for us. But what's touching is that an older gentleman came up to me afterwards with tears in his eyes. And he said, I wish I had heard that talk 30 years ago before my first marriage, you know? And I just said, and so we said a prayer, and I was tearing up then too, because that's quite meaningful to hear. But he said with great conviction that I have now, you know, had a similar conversion, and we are, you know, working the program, for lack of a better word. And I thought it was, so that was super encouraging. And he made some new friends, you know, I got a couple of, there's another podcast out there called Facts by Dr. Stephen Boyce, who is a postulant in the Diocese of the South. He was one of the speakers. I was really impressed with his talk and the way he was communicating. So I commend that podcast. I'm sure if I knew how to put something in the show notes, I would. But it was encouraging. I was encouraged all around. I came home grateful for the life the Lord has given me, you know, redoubled in my conviction of responsibility and hopefully a slightly better man. I mean, that's the hope.
Registration was limited to 100 men, right? Is it mostly clergy, or do you feel like the attendance was mostly laymen?
I asked that question directly to Father James, and he said it was 40% clergy, 60% lay. So I didn't know. I have a reason to ask him, because I wanted to know who to pitch my talk to.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of nice to have a good mix like that. You know, people did travel from, there was a guy there from California. There were people who traveled all over the place to be there.
I knew that was going to be the best part of it, was to see what lure this was going to attract.
Right. And, well, it was me. You know, I was a talker.
Yeah, you were the headliner. That's right.
Some guy named Calvin is there too, but it was mostly me.
So, yeah, I think that's safe to say.
So Matt, what was the topic of your talk?
Yeah, mine was my original understanding was I was going to talk on the masculine duty to defend the church. But then I looked online and I saw my talk had been changed to Mighty Men of Valor in the Culture War. And I said, oh my goodness, what am I going to do with this? So I just combined the two ideas. I thought, okay, we're going to talk about how to defend the church, and in particular, with regard to the particular threats that are incoming into local congregations from culture, feminism, Marxism, sexuality, all of that. And so I kind of laid out the problem in the first part of my talk, and I used Revelation 2 and the church in Thyatira to make a visual of the problem. And the church in Thyatira was in really bad shape. There was the woman that Jesus named Jezebel there, and she was leading the people there into sexual sin. And the situation was so bad that Jesus didn't say, hey guys, you need to fight against this person. You need to rise up and discipline this woman. Instead, Jesus said, hey, just hold on, because things are so far gone that you can't stop her. And what's interesting is in that text, the church of Thyatira is described as a church that has love and service and faithfulness and all like really good traits. So in that sense, it struck me that, if you visited the church in Thyatira on a Sunday morning, you might think it's a healthy church because you have
beautiful choral evensong, historic liturgy, beautiful cathedrals.
Yeah. Getting people like, right, how do you get there? I guess the thrust of my talk would be, will you get there because when husbands and fathers and brothers and pastors abdicate and they decide that this person, in this case, who Jesus calls Jezebel, is worth tolerating. You need to tolerate her.
Because, well, she's one of the biggest givers.
Right, right.
Her family's been coming here for generations.
She probably runs the Daughters of the King.
That's right.
Exactly. And so Jesus, in the very Christ-like way that he is, says, well, I'm going to come and I'm going to kill her and kill her children. so he says in the text. And I liken that, because that does remind me of, the couple that stays in the Episcopal Church when it starts going south, and you get, first it becomes their congregation becomes affirming. They say, okay, well, we're going to stay. And then 5 years later, they have a non-binary Wiccan communist as rector, and it's total disaster, and they look to people like the communion partner bishops to help them, and the communion partner bishops say something like, well, hey, there's Christians on both sides of this thing, like they said this last week. The communion partner bishops I use is maybe the primary one example of abdication in the face of the culture war. I do think it's one of the things I point out, I think, and maybe you guys have this too, but I think one of the key areas of sinfulness that I have, and I think a lot of men struggle with, is just passivity. It's a lot easier to do nothing than to do something. And it starts like when your kids are little, right? And your wife's in there struggling with him or something. And you can kind of hear it and you think, well, maybe I should go in and help her. But you think, well, but I could just turn the volume up on my podcast, or I could also just drink more beer and drown out the sound. And so it starts with that, right? That's an abdication. You're letting her deal with Leviathan by herself. And then that carries over to the church, right? When we're as a pastor, or even not as a pastor, as someone who's just in the church, men can attend the church, but not attend to the church. Hmm. They might just go, I'm here because my wife's here, or I'm here because, I just go and not pay attention to what's being taught, pay attention to what's being said in Sunday school, not paying attention to what books the book group is reading, not paying attention to who's teaching the children, not to mention what they're teaching, but who's teaching. And a willingness, I hear she's maybe they're reading some book that I don't quite like, but I'm just too tired to worry about it right now. That kind of thing. And that's how the church is over time subverted. So the beginning of that battle really is within the human soul, within the soul of every man who has to, I think, wake up every morning, confess his sins, or be reminded that he's forgiven, and then
strap on his sword.
Yeah, you're right. Right, exactly. So that was the basic gist of the talk. I also talked about how dangerous, I used some of Joe Wigney's stuff about how dangerous empathy can be when it's untethered.
Yeah, that's good.
You mean it's not dangerous in every single case? You mean it's not the worst sin in the world?
No. I spent a lot of time saying how wonderful it is that, in general, women tend to be more empathetic than men. They have to be. They gestate children. They care for them, and they, you know, when our kids were little, man, Anne like felt every pain that they had, and
I use the analogy. I use the example of having to fight back laughter when John stubs his toe, you know. I'm like, Elijah's put shoes on, son. Sorry. Like, told you once. Right. You'll learn it next time.
But without female empathy, though, the world would fall apart. Without the empathetic female, I think so many social relationships that we have now would crumble into the dust. Yeah. Because we don't care enough to do it, right? So they are the social glue, and their empathy is a great thing that God's given them. But it's a great thing so long as it's tethered to biblical truth and the headship of their husbands and their pastors. But the minute you unhook it from those things, it doesn't remain untethered. It tethers itself to the zeitgeist usually. So
that's actually a great image. You can imagine like a fishing boat in the wind and waves with one of those hooks. It's hooked onto something, but God save you if it comes unhooked and it's flashing, waving all over the place, and it's going to catch onto something, and it's going to be dangerous when it does.
That was a great point, Matt. Yeah, I thought it was one of the best talks. I thought that was there, and I was very edified by it because precisely that. I mean, I think you said that, you know, was it untethered empathy and the men who are seeking approval of those women are the problem? And I think that was a really apt and insightful observation. And I think that is the problem. I mean, you know, the number of people, what do they call it online? The white knights, you know, falling over themselves to be agreeable to disagreeable women who are spouting often, particularly in the church, I mean, not all of them, but the ones that are heretical things. And then we see how it slides into apostasy. I mean, this is what's happening all around the world. And so, you know, it was a really, really good talk. And I think if anyone goes, and I don't know how you get the recordings, but it's worth the price, whatever it is, to hear that.
Obviously, Calvin was another speaker. There were several more. How are the other talks?
Calvin started off. He was Friday night, Thursday night.
His theme was, he sort of recounted some of the, you know, kind of the way that his talk at Mere Anglicanism had been received, which was not unfamiliar to people. We've covered that here too. But his basic theme was, you know, that weak men, that men need to, you know, that this is the problem with the church and society, is that there are men who need to be more courageous and by extension, more stronger. I think, I mean, that's basically the gist of, I mean, he's a good speaker. I mean, he was the headliner for sure.
Yeah. And then, the next morning, that was
doctors.
Yeah, he used Paul at Mars Hill, Areopagus, and I think the thrust of his talk was how to deal intellectually, how to face intellectual. The mighty men of valor and intellectual
academia, I think it was.
Academia, that's what it was. Yeah. So,
because it makes sense because he's got a apologetics ministry. I mean, that's what he does, and he's an expert on the canon, which I found pretty fascinating. I read the required books on it, but nothing further. So, and he was talking about how, and we do, I think this is what we try to do here too. I mean, you have to exegete the culture essentially, in order to understand how to defend the faith within it. And so if you're just dismissing, you know, what's going on in TikTok or what's going on in the culture, what your kids are reading, if you're dismissing all that, it's just either unchristian or uninteresting. Well, then you're failing your job as a father, as a husband, as a neighbor, for that matter. And it was convicting, although it was also encouraging, because I was like, well, we were right with you. I mean, that's when I went up after, when I was like, we need to keep talking, because I think we're pulling the same direction here. And it was very encouraging. And he's coming into the ACNA, I mean, by God willing.
Yeah.
So that was, I was heartened by that.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought one of the more profound talks was by Trip Parker on work, masculinity and work. And he went through Genesis 1 and 2 and also dealt with 3, the curse, and relayed out for Anglicans. I mean, Anglicans should be some of the more some of the deepest thinkers on the question of the cultural mandate, but I don't think we are. I think the Presbyterians have taken that from us. But he talked about what the cultural mandate is. The when God tells Adam and Eve to exercise dominion over the earth, what that means, and how that creates, how God instituted that point in human culture, and how work is just fundamental to a man's life. We were commanded to work not only before the fall.
That's right. It was good. It was good that we would be workers.
Which makes good work good. Right. But also even before Eve was created, right? So we were, this was a specific, we were put in the garden to work it before she came around. And one of the interesting points that he made was that, you know, we men tend to want to build things and create things, but then the woman comes along
and then knock them down.
So in a functioning world makes them beautiful. Right. So like I could, you know, a man can make a home, build a house. Right. But then if he's the decorator, man, I feel bad for the house. You got to have a woman come in there.
Well, or that's the creative pattern of Genesis anyway. With like a bare light bulb hanging down. Just college string.
This is the testimony of our college dorm rooms.
Exactly. I thought you only washed your sheets when you went home for breaks.
Wait, you can wash sheets?
That's right. Maza was horrified when I told her that. And I was like, well, I didn't know. I don't know.
Matt was complimenting the talk.
No, it was really good. The encouraging thing was just how he retold the story. If you haven't read the book, you should read it. A Leaf by Neagle. It's J.R. Tolkien's very short story. And in this story, Neagle is a painter, or he wants to be a painter. And he's painstakingly painting this leaf on a tree. And he has this next door neighbor who just keeps getting into trouble. He has to stop his work and help his neighbor. His neighbor's, you know, he breaks things. His neighbor gets sick. His neighbor, all these kinds of things. He finally is getting to the point where he's finishing the leaf, and then his neighbor, the roof is leaking, and his neighbor uses this beautiful portrait of his leaf to stop up the leaking roof, and it's just a disaster, you know. It's just, and that's kind of the picture of work under the curse, isn't it? We work really hard, we try to do our things, but there's always distractions, there's always things keeping us from it. We don't ever get to have the perfect thing we want. But then Neagle dies, and he sees the tree, not just the leaf, but the entire tree that he was painting the leaf of in heaven. God had taken none of his work fell through the ground. Every bit of every ounce of his labor, God saved up and kept and beautified and made more glorious than it was when he done it. And that's what God does with our work, right? Even it might feel futile. I mean, I think Tripp is a coder, right? So he was talking about he coded a language or coded, I'm not sure what I'm talking about, but coded something for computers like 5 years ago. And the code is like prehistoric now. No one uses it. Yeah. So he says that you feel like you're just kind of blowing into the wind. And yet we have to remember that Ecclesiastes is answered by the gospel, and that the futility and the vaporousness of Ecclesiastes, labor under the sun, is glorified and kept and held for us by God in heaven.
So that's the code that will make heaven run.
What's that? Yeah, that's right. God is coding.
There'll be no computers in heaven.
Using that code in heaven. Right. No, but I mean, like, if you have a job, like in, you know, stocking things in some store, right? You
could, or like Jiffy Lube.
Yeah, you could feel like you don't. What am I doing? I'm not making any impact at all. But God holds that stuff.
Right. That's why we were created to produce and serve, you know, our wives and families through the labor of our hands. I mean, because you can change a lot of oil if you know that you're buying diapers, you know, for little babies, you know, that can sustain you I'm sure changing oil is probably more interesting than a lot of stuff I do throughout the day. So, you know, I wish I could learn how to do it. But no, that was a good talk. I mean, they were all very poignant and very timely. I mean, that's really the question. You know, we're sitting there actively asking as a culture, is it good to be a man? You know, what is a man? What is the meaning of masculinity over against quote unquote toxic masculinity? And so, you know, there were men there that were, that by their own admission had been denigrated or sort of dismissed simply by, on account of being a man, and were, you know, trying to respond in a Christian way. I mean, that's what was encouraging to me, is that we were at a church, we were at a Christian conference, you know, we were praying, we were singing, we were, you know, we're being ministered to in a way that you can imagine men that are starting to react against the cultural headwinds that they're receiving could do it in a much less Christian way, you know, much like, I mean, we see that all around, you know, the sort of the pickup artist guys or the people that are just, you know, trying to, that's right, the men going their own way movement, they say. And so that was what was encouraging to me, is that I think that we have a position and a historic sort of rootedness in the goodness of masculinity that's not over against or at the denigration of women, but it's together as the image of God working in unity and in tandem, for the good of themselves and for the good of their neighbors. And so I, you know, the number of men, the young men that came that were actively, you know, either dating to marry or looking for someone to begin seriously dating, and was encouraging, because essentially they will take the admonition we gave them to be the leaders in their home, particularly with respect to church. And then the final talk, as we saw, James Gadomski, if I'm pronouncing that incorrectly, I apologize, but very sincere, very impassioned talk about what is the sort of masculinity or the worship as warfare, I think, or something like this. But basically is that the church, you know, was a place where we were actively defending the bride, but also, you know, establishing the kingdom like a bolt beachhead in the middle of a hostile territory. And, you know, all the prayers and all the singing and the confessing and the preaching, all of this were means to an end for defending the faith. And I thought it was well said. And you know, again, I'm sure there are other good Anglican churches in Spartanburg, at least I've heard. But I certainly think it'd be worth checking out this church too, if you're sort of looking around, just to see, at least meet some of these people that were very fervent and faithful.
He also talked about how, you know, I'm sure that was fascinating, worship as sacrifice. And he wasn't talking about the sacrifice of the mass or anything like that. What he meant was, you know, every act of love toward, you know, an individual requires sacrifice. So you get married, you have to suddenly, you have to conform yourself to your wife, not in a servile way, but you conform yourself to her and she conforms herself to you, and you kind of meld together and you become what you really are, one flesh, over time. And so the kind of the modern urge to make everything on the outside of me conform to the inside of me is the reverse of this. You're causing the world to worship you by sacrificing itself. You're causing the people who you're related to die so that you can be worshiped, if you want your inner authentic self to be admired and affirmed. Whereas with worship, the real worship anyway, not the big box megachurch kind of worship, but real worship, not saying that they don't worship, don't get me wrong, but the point was that if everything in your church and your worship of your church is built and designed to please you, there's no sacrifice. You're not,
that's right,
there's nothing you're conforming yourself to. You're just, you are being admired, you're being loved, you're being worshiped in some way. But in a real worship situation, you have to conform yourself to the creeds. You have to conform yourself to the liturgy. You have to conform yourself to words that you might not say on your own, but that are said for you and that you believe. Yep. You have to give yourself over to confession. You have to confess your sins, right? There's an act of laying yourself down on the altar every time you come to church on Sunday, which is an act of love and a very masculine act. I mean, women do it too in their own way, of course, but men have to lay ourselves down before our King and let him rule us. And that's an act of adoration and sacrifice.
Yeah, it was a really powerful talk. I mean, as a result of it, I came back and immediately took the cushions off of all of the kneelers in the sanctuary just to show people it's not about you. No, I'm kidding. But I was, but it did, it certainly made sense of why he had such quality and sort of, again, thorough liturgical practice at his church, because, you know, he really, which I commend him for. I mean, it was obvious, it explained in a certain sense with all of the pomp and circumstance that we had been
What might seem with. Otherwise like pomp and circumstance, you're saying,
is actually
full of life. And
that's right. Yeah, I misspoke. That's exactly right. Yeah. And so it was great. I mean, we do more in our church, even though we're not particularly high church, than, you know, many people, as they tell me often, were used to or accustomed to in their Baptist church or their non-denominational church. So I was encouraged that, and not necessarily to go all the way. That, you know, you have to take into account your local customs, right? But I was encouraged that we were in the same ballpark, at the very least, playing the same game, you know, just slightly a little bit more ornate there, perhaps. But it was great. We had the question and answer session at the end, which, you know, was interesting, because it really helped flesh out a little bit of some of the talks. But basically, there's a obvious sense among the people there, at least, that there was a there's confusion around what it means to be a man, and that the church has a decided answer to offer, and what are some of the best ways to articulate that, to defend it, to communicate it to, you know, your neighbors. And so it was good. I was encouraged all around.
Well, as we talked about a couple weeks ago, this is just one of a series of conferences on this similar topic. The audio of JD and Liza's talks at our fall retreat is up on the Grace Anglican website. Hopefully this Perseus conference audio will be available at some point. I'm not sure if it was recorded. I did see some iPhones on the lectern in a lot of the great photography I saw from the conference. And then JD, you've got your conference upcoming in February. You excited about that, I guess?
Yeah, we are. We're starting to take sort of signups already. And we've got, it's February 27th, 28th, and March 1st, which is a Thursday. It's basically, I was laughing with James, it's the same setup. We have a opening talk, then we have a sort of a get together afterwards. Then on Friday morning, we continue with a number of talks, culminating in a choral Eucharist that afternoon. And then we have another talk Saturday morning and a panel discussion, and then we leave. And so we're excited to welcome the headliner, I think it's safe to say, is the Reverend Dr. Hans Boersma from Neshota House. But we have a number of other speakers. And again, it's a variation on a theme. I mean, we're looking at what it means to be a human, the goodness of masculinity, the goodness of femininity. We're going to be worshiping the whole time through, and hopefully, I assume, meeting new people, making new friends, and forging deeper bonds of affection amongst those we know, and creating new ones where they don't currently exist, all to the end of continuing to have the church that we've been called to strengthened and the relationships deepened, so that when we face what seems to be increasingly strong headwinds on these questions, you know, Christian public proclamation of what it means to be a man and a woman, and the goodness of marriage, and the limits on sexuality, and the goodness of children, and the dignity of humanity from birth, from conception and natural death, and all the things that continue to be more and more contentious, the more relationships we have, you know, the more networks we can form, and the deeper our sort of shared convictions can be, the better for us all. When we individually face this, we won't be standing alone, but in fact, we'll have interconnected webs of shared conviction, and which can only beget courage. You know, courage begets courage. And so the muscles that you get trained when you go to conferences like this, that you begin talking about yourself and others in ways that perhaps you're more reticent to alone. And that's can only to the end of you developing not only a language, but the ability to speak when spoken to for the sake of your neighbor. You know, you can in fact find out that you can just tell your confused nephew what's actually true. You know, you can sit down with your wife and have a hard conversation about prioritizing church over travel baseball. You know, you can begin to do these things when you know that not only are you not alone, but that you are speaking something true, and then by extension, sacrificially loving to those who we've been called to lead and to serve. And so I'm excited that these these are happening. You know, I wish that every church would have some access to, you know, throwing some sort of conference like this, or maybe retreat, or at the very least, the pastors sending these resources to their congregation. Because, you know, it's not like we're not looking to have 1,000 people and make $1 million. You know, I think we're having 200, 250 or so, but it's to the end of comforting and strengthening, you know, the actual people who are floundering and looking for answers and hope. And we are the arbiters of hope, not by us, but through Christ. And he has given us the answers. So I'm excited. So yeah, sign up. You could put a link in the show notes. Y'all come down to Hilton Head in late February. You know, it won't be swimming weather, but it won't be, you might have to wear a sweater. That's about it, you know.
But what's the name of the conference? Really fun.
It's called To Be Human, Ourselves, Our Souls, and Bodies, which, as some of you know, is from the, what do we call it in the ACNA prayer book? It's from Rite One. It's from the Anglican Standard Eucharistic Prayer, where we say, "In here, Lord, we present ourselves, our souls, and bodies to be a living sacrifice unto thee, or unto you." And so that was, that's what it's about. And so it's not the end of the conversation for sure, but we're just continuing it. And I'm grateful for both your conference, Nick, to begin thinking about it, and this opportunity to hear another angle on it this past weekend. And you know, who knows if there's another one that pops up before February, maybe we'll make a road trip again. But if not, then we'll have a lot of food for thought by the time we get there.
And registration is open for your conference?
It is open. Yeah, go to stlukeshhi.org, and somewhere on that page there will be a click for the link. Mm-hmm. So
And we'll, I have it on good authority that there will at least be one way in which the St. Luke's conference will be superior to the Perseus conference, which is that I will be there.
That's right. Nick will be there. Matt will be there. Ann will be there. And I'm hoping that, yeah. So if anyone's listening there and wants to come down, we have some scholarship money available. We could probably talk if you need to be put up. You know, I mean, we'll work.
We'd love
with
to
you.
See you.
Yeah, man.
Well, that's going to be the time that we have this week. Thank you for listening to Stand Firm. If you want to keep the conversation going, you can be in touch with us. Rate and review the podcast on iTunes. Send us an email at mailbag@standfirminfaith.com. Follow us on social media. Join the Anglicans for the Gospel Facebook group. Thanks to J.D. Koch and Matt Kennedy. I'm Nick Landon, and Lord willing, we'll be back next week. Until then, by the grace of God and Jesus Christ, we'll be standing firm.